I was trying to figure out where it all went wrong. Now, you don't have to do it now. Now, hold that, not the easy there now. Just relax. That comes much later. Much later. I was trying to figure out where it all went wrong. You see, I was writing these plays. I was working very hard to tell the world what I feel about the world. I was constructing them very carefully. And then today I am up here in Parnassus, and I was reading in the New York Times, which is delivered here one day late. One day late it comes here. Well, I understand the New York Times is planning to have a regular edition up here in heaven. So we get the news on the same day, you know, but they always be as late here. Well, one day late I was reading that in the paper after I had written all these plays and worked very hard on them, that Lotta Lenya is going to play the male role in one of my plays. And it says a very interesting, a very difficult theatrical trick will be tried down in the village in the off-Broadway theater when Lotta Lenya will play the male lead in a play by Bertolt Brecht. Now, I know Miss Lenya from way back, and I do not know where Miss Lenya... Anyway, I was trying to work my way through all the undergrowth there, and I came across that most significant item in the New York Times yesterday. I think we've gone full circle. Did any of you read that little piece? Well, for those of you who were confused there by the terrible accent, I would like to tell you that there was a piece in the paper. It said, a new theatrical venture and a very difficult trick will be played and attempted by Miss Lotta Lenya, the famous actress, who will play the male lead in a play by Bertolt Brecht. And as all of you know, Miss Lenya has worked in the German theater and has performed in many of Kurt Weill, her ex-husband, her late husband's works, and Bertolt Brecht. Well, I'm sitting there reeling under the impact of that, and I'm not imputing Miss Lotta Lenya's talents as an actress, but the idea of Miss Lotta Lenya playing the male lead in a play by Bertolt Brecht is one of the most grotesque and sick things I've heard in many a year. You know, how would it be if one day it was announced that Mr. Gene Shepard is going to assay the role, a very difficult performance, is going to assay the role of Blanche DuBois in a Tennessee Williams play named Streetcar Named Desire. All together. Ho-ho! Ho-ho! Come on, gang, let's go! Let's go! Come on up. California! Here I come! Right back where I started from.
Where flowers bloom in the sun.
Bloom in the sun.
Each morning, birdies dawning,
and the birdies are singing.
Oh! Ho-ho!
Crying out loud. I suddenly realized that I don't know anything about California, Here I Come. I just know... No, don't put it back again. Now, don't you... He knows. It's, let him handle it there. He's pretty good. You know, I'll tell you this thing about Miss Lenya. I suppose it's the general creeping unreality of our things, the things that we live in. I'm afraid I didn't bring my gothic music up here. I should have a little gothic music for this. No, it's not there. No. Well, I suppose in lieu of gothic music for this comment here, we might as well do the... We might as well... Yes, that's just as good. Now, hold it there. I'll give you the cue there, because it has to be done carefully. No, I'll tell you what. Lee, dig up my cheap guitar music, because I think in a way it says pretty much about this same situation here. Any of you out there, I wonder whether or not we would stand for Laurence Olivier playing Lady Macbeth. Is there anybody would like to raise their hands and say you'd like to see that done? Any of you out there like to see Anthony Perkins play Audrey Hepburn? Any of you out there? Or, oh, yeah, I know the crowd of this as he is already. Well, that's all right. That's just your opinion there now. Let's not be snotty out there. Police say Gilbert Clarence Ziendorf. A 6-inch knife stuck between his shoulder blades. Turned to his wife and said gently, "Honey, you shouldn't have done that." Officers gave this account of how Ziendorf, 39, electrician, and his wife, Eleanor, 37, spent last evening. They went to a bar and had words. Then they went to the parking lot where Ziendorf, bending over to transfer clothes from her car to his, felt a sharp pain in his back. At first, officers quoted him as saying, I didn't know what it was, but I was near a streetlight, and when I turned sideways and looked at my shadow on a wall, I could see a knife handle sticking out. He went back to the bar and said, Will someone pull this knife out of my back, please? There were no takers, but someone called police. When officers arrived, Ziendorf greeted them with these words. Officers, I need some help for my wife. When officers asked him what was wrong, he turned and showed them the knife blade, saying eloquently, "This." Now, don't get panicky, he continued. Don't get panicky, fellas. I've been stabbed before. I was stabbed in the heart when I was 12. The blood was really spurting then. Officers took him to a hospital where, an hour after the stabbing, the knife was removed. Ziendorf was sent home after treatment. Mrs. Ziendorf was booked on suspicion of assault with intent to commit murder. Her husband is fighting the charges. Oh, that's lovely. I just thought you ought to know that things are changing out. Oh, yes, once more. Bring it again. Bring it again, yet, Mick. And now for all of you showbiz fans, all of your home movie fans, we now have an advertisement from the home movie department, the camera directory of the Chicago Tribune and the New York Sunday Times. All ready? Alert. Home movie sale. 8mm 50-foot subjects, 79 cents each. Wonderful show business personalities and favorites such as these are now available. Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Snub Pollard, Nazi atrocities, cartoons, and others. 200-foot subjects, 298 and up. Send your name and address to Entertainment Films Company. Oh, what next? Oh, what next? Somebody came in. Somebody just called in and offered me the role of Blanche Dubois, off-Broadway producer who wants to do some creative casting. Or was it an Audrey Hepburn fan that called in? It was just one of the engineers that were having a buzz in the transmitter. Is that it? Well, you know, it's a funny thing. The nature of violence is very subtle. And things can be done that are very violent that never show as violence themselves. I'll never forget, again relating to the problem of violence, I'll never forget one of the most violent acts that I've ever heard of committed in a theater, and some acts can be violent even though they're very passive, is the idea of Siobhan McKenna a few seasons back playing Hamlet, which
makes one of the most grotesque comments both on our theater and perhaps even on the constitution of Hamlet himself. But whether or not this seems to you to be violence, I don't know. It just seems to be unbelievable violence. Speaking of violence, this is WOR, AM and FM New York, your old friendly, reliable, sober station, and we're here with a firm grip on things. There's one thing about WOR, it has a good, solid grasp on the way it is, right? All right. Well, now, I'll never forget one time when I read this little piece about the guy getting the thing in the back there. I remember an incident. Can you recall the first time that you ever were witness to or heard about or saw genuine violence? Well, this is by way of nature. I know you do, Don. You've been here long enough to see plenty of it. And this is by way of an educational-type program tonight. Hey, kids, a lot of you kids out there wonder why we always have wars. Well, it isn't really exactly why you think. You know, there are two schools of thought about war. One school of thought is the nutty school that holds that all wars are economic. That all wars are economic, that if you could get the economics of the situation squared away, all them guys making a dough on a war, all those people making all kinds of dough about war, let me tell you, there wouldn't be no wars. Never any wars. Somebody just called in and offered me the role of Gilda in Rigoletto. Well, I'll give you a little sample of that. You have the Gypsy Love Song up there? You should give me a Gypsy Love Song. I've had many, many, many requests to do Sylvia. I've had requests to do the Gypsy Love Song. I've had requests to do the Indian Love Call, which, as we know, is a tune that has deep and very, 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 singularly true meanings for many people. All together, Don. There we go. Oh, this is just lovely. I can just bathe in this and let it drip down over my ears. Bring it up now. It's got an introduction. What do you mean? I don't play introductions. Here we go. No, that's not the Indian Love Call that I used to do with the harmonica. For crying out loud, I can't do that one. Now, you just throw that out. Right, don't bother with it. You just throw that out. It's very good, but just throw it away. That's one of the 50 great moments in music, but it blew a tire there on the way in. That's well, you know, by way of education, I'm about 9 years old at one point. It's hard to believe it, but I was nine once. It's hard to believe that anybody was nine once. But there I was, about 9 years old, and we had about a block and a half from our house. We had a little grocery store. Now, grocery stores come into two categories these days, and in fact, they always did. There was the supermarket, which is and will always remain singularly impersonal. The supermarket is an impersonal place that is very jazzy and always reminds you of a great big party to which somehow you have been invited, but nobody knows you. And it's a lot of fun going on there, and it's all kinds of fun, you know, where the record player is blaring and all people are dancing, big square dances in the middle of the aisles there. But nobody knows anybody else, and perhaps it's best that nobody does. This is the feeling that you get in a supermarket. But then there's the other kind. There's those little grocery stores that are stuck in among the big ones, you know, Don, where there's one little greasy guy with an apron with all kinds of dirty thumbprints all over his apron, you know, and a little blood that's dripped down the front where he's chopped open the... Yeah, he's chopped up the spare ribs, you know, and he's working away there, and he's selling the stuff. Well, now, this is a guy who is selling food. He is not a market operator. He's not selling packages. He's just down there selling food. Well, about two blocks away from my home, and in fact, in everybody's neighborhood in those days, there was a grocery store. Now, this was in the heart of the Depression. People bought at grocery stores for a number of reasons in those days, not the least of which is they had to eat. But they bought at most grocery stores, many of them, primarily because they were extended credit. Now, you don't see much in the way of credit grocery stores around anymore, but they had a thing that they called the book. You ever hear about the book? And the usually right next to the cash register, there was a great big wooden case. And in this wooden case, there was stuck a whole pile, all alphabetically arranged, of little books, little paper books that had a white back on them, somebody's name written on them, and they kept the account of the individual or the family who was involved in that particular book. And I used to always be vaguely impressed by people who had a book. We didn't. Strangely enough, our family always bought on cash. And my mother had a peculiar puritanical delight in that fact. Whether or not it was good or bad, it was basically un-American, of course. But she always used to say, well, no, we, Mrs. Bruner, we buy cash. Well, of course, that would kill old Lady Bruner, whose husband worked one day a week at the roundhouse. And who used to spend every lousy nickel he got at the roundhouse that very night celebrating his day of work at Flick's Tavern. And so she never saw cash from one year to the next. Actually, once in a while, she'd get something from her father, a little thing like that. But cash, it was nil. Well, old Mattingly, who ran the grocery store down at the end of the street there, was kind of like part of the neighborhood and yet not. A guy who sells stuff to other people is never really part of the neighborhood, not actually. He likes to pretend he is. He belongs to the PTA and all that stuff. But he is a separate thing. He is one of the haves. You know what I mean by the haves? Even if it's a little bit, he is one of the haves. He is the guy you have to go to get the credit. He does not ask for credit. He gives credit. Very different proposition. And so Mr. Mattingly is working down there in his little store every day with Mrs. Mattingly. And they got this little meat department there, and along one side they got the little, the grocery shelves where all the Campbell's pork and beans are all piled up. It's a little bitty store. Now, it wasn't a little store by those standards, by the standards of the stores of the day, but today it would just be called a deli, you know? It was just a deli, that's all it was. But it sold more than deli stuff. It sold, like, hamburger, and it sold stuff like... They used to call it chopped round steak. It was hamburger, that old, greasy old nothing hamburger. And there it was, and it sold summer sausage and stuff. Well, old Mattingly used to stand behind the counter all the time, and he would dispense groceries to those who paid for them. He would dispense credit to those who didn't. Now, I don't know whether he charged more for the credit or not, but I do know that there were thousands of people who went there only because they could get credit during the Depression. Well, it was part of the life. It was as much part of your life as like your bathroom and your house is part of your life, or your kitchen or the backyard. I mean, there was Mattingly's. So you go to Mattingly's. Okay. Well, now this was in the very heart of the Depression. And a lot of people would stay around home. There wasn't a great deal of going to work, for obvious reasons. There were people hanging around, talking and stuff. And at that very period, there was an interesting phenomenon, which you don't hear much about and which I was really reminded of here the other day when they caught this guy Nussbaum. You remember Nussbaum, the number one? It seems sad that the number one enemy in America is named Nussbaum. I mean, you can't get mad at a guy named Al Nussbaum. Somebody, you just say, come on, Al, will you knock it off? And the sad way they caught him, his girlfriend or his wife or whatever, she says, well, I think he was tired and he just wanted to give up. Did you hear her comment? Well, that wasn't the way Dillinger was. And you see, in our neighborhood, the big guy was Dillinger. How many of you ever hear of John Dillinger? Well, John Dillinger was absolutely the number one celebrity in Lake County, Indiana. He was like Mary Martin is here, really, and for many of the same reasons. It was very expensive to be tangled up with Dillinger, and he was also very colorful, you see. But one of the things that happened in that particular period was this incident regarding Mr. Mattingly. And, of course, everybody is always talking about Dillinger. He was in the headlines. He had knocked over about four banks in the neighborhood, and he'd made a wild escape. A big sensational escape from... how many of you remember that sensational escape that Dillinger made when he carved the gun out of soap or wood or something? Well, that happened about a mile or 2 miles away from our home in a crazy town called Crown Point, Indiana. Let me tell you about Crown Point, Indiana. Crown Point, Indiana is the county seat of Lake County. Now, the county seat means absolutely nothing. I couldn't tell you. I don't even know what county... What county is Manhattan in, Don? counties, is it Manhattan County? I don't know what it is. Counties don't mean anything here, but out in places like Indiana and Illinois, the county is a very important unit. And people talk about going over to Cook County, or they talk about going down to Posey County. And they refer to places where they live. Can you imagine a man referring to where he lives as a certain county? Oh, yeah. Many times you will hear a guy in Indianapolis, Indiana, for example, you'll hear somebody talking in a gas station or in a Needix or something or a White Castle. A guy will say, well, I'll tell you, I come from down in Posey County. And you say, no, Posey County? Well, for crying out loud, do you know old Hunk Williamson down there in Posey County? I know old Hunk. You remember Hunk Williamson down on 221. You remember him? You know Hunk? He'd say, yeah, I knew Hunk. Went to high school with him. Let me tell you, I know who you are. You're one of the Jamesons from Brown County, of course. Well, so the county is a very definite unit of Indiana. Well, Lake County is a northern county in Indiana, and a very important county in Indiana. It's clinging to the coattails of Chicago, and it's hanging right on Lake Michigan, and that's why it's called Lake County. And yet it still retains that strange country air of being a county. As a matter of fact, they used to have the county fair was a big deal in Lake County, Indiana. Well, the county seat is kind of the UN of a county. It's sort of like the Washington, D.C. of a county. Well, Crown Point, Indiana, was the county seat. And there was a peculiar kind of glamour to everybody. Even it's a little bitty town, by the way. There was a certain glamour to everybody. Whenever anyone would mention Crown Point, Indiana, it was the county seat. It had a certain glamour. It was like the headquarters, you know, the main office. It was the big thing. Well, Crown Point, Indiana's who are involved in great, enormous, tremendous events in other people's lives, they begin to laugh at fate. Many a mortician right out there tonight is laughing at fate. Seriously. He is, you know, because he's a mortician. You'd be surprised at how many obstetricians constantly look up at the sky and laugh at the gods just because of what they're involved in. Well, so do guys who marry 87,000 people a year. You know, they laugh at, there goes a couple, there goes another two, Hetty. You old bitty. And he slaps his wife across the bottom. Well, so you get a very different world there. And in the middle of Crown Point, Indiana, was the Crown Point Jail. Well, John Dillinger was captured one day, and I don't know the details of his capture, but everybody in Lake County, Indiana, was kind of stunned because Dillinger was sort of uncapturable, you know? He was like a combination of all kinds of weird things. He was a combination of Al Capone. He had a little bit of Robin Hood thrown in there, although I don't know why, because, of course, everybody was down and out in the Depression, and it seemed that this was, you know, he was making it. He was one of the nothing people making it. He was from Indiana, you know, Muncie. So everybody was kind of like on his side, and yet they were against him. Well, there was a combination of things going there, and then one day he got picked up and thrown into jail in Crown Point, Indiana. Well, of course, the town was sort of stunned. And he was just in there about 2 days, and there was a picture. What's going on in there anyway? There was a picture of Dillinger with his arm around the sheriff of Lake County, Indiana. And it was, you remember that famous picture? And it's a big jovial picture, you know, and it's like the sheriff is just so happy to see old John, and John is so happy to see the sheriff. Two lodge buddies have gathered together there. And it's a famous picture of Dillinger being greeted at the county jail by the sheriff. Well, strangely enough, in keeping with the whole attitude of Crown Point and the whole world of that day, 2 days later, Dillinger was sprung. He got out of the pokey by carving a knife out of a bar of Fell's Naphtha soap. Or something similar. And you know, it was a very crude gun, very obviously a phony, but he jumped up out of his sack one day and says, all right, hands up, all of you. All right, I got the drop on you. Now, come on, open the door here. And they opened the door, and John was allowed to run out into the night where a large waiting limousine, a black panting automobile, picked him up, and they whisked out to the highways of Indiana, there again to take up their career of crime. So you got the whole sight there, the whole scene. This is just the way it was. Well, poor little old Mattingly, one day, was working in his store. And this was a neighborhood store, remember, friendly little neighborhood store. And we lived on the main highway. Now, this is probably the most significant thing that has to be said. Hammond, Indiana, was on the main highway that led from central Indiana to Chicago. Now, Chicago was the big time, you know. Of course, this was Al Capone, the whole big time up there. And Dillinger worked really out of Indiana. He was from Muncie, Indiana. Oh, yeah, Muncie, Indiana. And he worked out of Indiana, and he would hit the big towns glancing blows. He would come whistling in and bop Chicago. You know, he would belt a bank right on the outskirts of Chicago and whistle back into Indiana. And, of course, Indiana was like the wilds. It was like the jungles as far as the Chicago police were concerned and the feds and everybody else. And he would hit them, and then he would whistle back. And there's a very famous story, you know, about John Dillinger one day returning. And it's a true story, too. It's been told many times. And I don't know whether you've ever heard it or not. But the famous story of John Dillinger, when the heat was really on him, and he was a famous, the number one, absolutely the number one criminal, the number one crime celebrity in the country. John Dillinger, one day, on a Sunday, returned to Muncie, Indiana, his hometown. And he came from a very simple family. He did not come from a crime family or anything like that. And he returned to Muncie. Well, the story of John Dillinger walking around the streets of Muncie, Indiana, on a Sunday afternoon, in the town where he went to high school. And, of course, they all knew it was John Dillinger. John Dillinger was the biggest guy from town, you know. And he walked up and down the streets. And there is a beautiful story about that. It's actually not a story. It's a report of the quiet Sunday. And, by the way, this is a heavy Protestant, Bible, God-fearing belt. And John Dillinger, on that quiet Sunday afternoon, parking his great big black limousine with three thugs who sat in the car in the gas station, and who covered him while he got out and walked up and down the streets of his hometown. And he walked along the sidewalks of his town, and they followed him in this great big straight eight Packard. Three guys sitting in the front, two guys in the back, all of them with Thompson submachine guns and 45s in their lap, and poor old Dillinger is walking around the streets of Muncie, Indiana. Did you ever hear that story? Well, it's a wild one. It would make a great naked city. Really would. It would make a great naked city of the big town crook going home to the little town, and he knows he's going to get it, you know. He knows he's going to get it, and he visited his home. He went up to his house and sat on a Sunday afternoon with his mother and father and sat there for a couple of hours on the front porch, and, of course, everybody's afraid to open their trap in the neighborhood, and that great big old black Packard sat out there and didn't move a muscle. And just quietly sat there and burned gas while they waited. And finally, when it was over, John walked down off the front porch of this old frame house, walked down the steps between all the snowball bushes, walked across the curb, into the back of that car, and they disappeared, never to return to Muncie, Indiana. A fantastic story. Well, now, the main drag between Muncie and Indianapolis and Chicago is a road called U.S. 41. Have you ever heard of it? Well, U.S. 41, that's another thing. The roads and the highways out in the Midwest are like major arteries, literally, of a person's body. The whole state, for example, will hang on a U.S. highway just like a grape hanging onto a branch or an apple growing from a branch of a tree. That somehow the highway is an entity unto itself. U.S. 41, U.S. 52, U.S. 53. These are great highways that cut right down through the middle of Indiana, straight down. And everybody's life is measured by how far he lives from 41, or from 52, or from 53, or from U.S. 30, or from 6. U.S. 30, the Lincoln Highway, cuts right across the top of Indiana and sort of skirts the lake. And U.S. 30 was like a big celebrity in itself. When you hit 30, you knew that 30 landed somewhere in Los Angeles. Yeah. You were walking on Los Angeles when you walked across 30. And you were also walking across New York. Because 30 went all the way to New York, you know. And there it was. It was two great big things that hung on to Indiana that attached to the major world outside. Well, U.S. 41 was about, about 6 blocks from my house. Well, there were a couple of little streets that ran off of 41, and every time there was a great big hijacking because of the physical location of the neighborhood where we lived, the big-time crooks, do you know what hijacking is? Well, hijacking is one mob holding up another mob, literally. If the word got out that Daniel Bannion, for example, who was a famous... Do you remember... Did you ever see the movie Al Capone? Well, do you remember the guy that was shot in the floral shop? That was Daniel Bannion, tough Daniel Bannion, a tough Irish kid from the south side of Chicago who was an Irish Catholic kid and who ran as his front a series of florist shops in Chicago. His deadly enemy was Al Capone, who operated on the north side of Chicago. You see, Chicago was divided into two battlegrounds, the north side and the south side. And Capone had the north side all sewed up, and Daniel Bannion operated out of the south side, but he had infiltrated into the north side. Now, you see where the problem was, right there. There was a gigantic clash. There was only room for one guy, and in the end, O'Bannion got it. But my father used to tell wild stories. He came from the neighborhood where Daniel Bannion grew up. Now, how many of you have ever read Studs Lonergan, the Lonergan trilogy? Well, now, this is not fiction, you know. James T. Farrell grew up in the same neighborhood where my father grew. And my old man used to tell stories. He had one phrase that he used to use all the time. He said, I'll tell you what the neighborhood was like. You either went into the mobs or you got out. There was just no choice. You either went into the mobs or you got out when you were a kid there, when you were 18 or 19 or 20, something like that. There was just no other choice. And the whole neighborhood that the Lonergan trilogy was written about was the area around 55th and Union, down around Emerald Avenue in Chicago. This is the area that is not too far from the University of Chicago. And it is the area which used to be the old Gold Coast, the back of the yards area, and a very historic, fascinating place in America. And it was this neighborhood that spawned the Daniel Bannions. And, of course, Al Capone was an import, you know. Capone came from the East. He was not a native Chicagoan, and he had originally made his reputation in Pittsburgh and then came out to Chicago and was kind of imported by another mobster, but he shortly took over the mob, and it became Capone's gang. Now, they used to use U.S. 41, was the major artery between Chicago and Kentucky, where the bootleg whiskey was made in the hills of Kentucky. And Indiana was sandwiched in between. Now, you got the picture? Nobody ever does movies about the states in between the wild states. They're even wilder, because that's called no man's land. That's where they really slug it out. Oh, yeah, it's like the ground between the trenches, literally. And so we were close to one trench and not quite part of another trench. And, I can remember, every couple of months, you'd wake up and park down about two or three doors down, or maybe right in front of the house, or maybe in the next block. There'd be a great big truck. Yeah, just parked there. And the truck is not moving, nothing, just silent, parked. Big one. And has Illinois license plates, or some strange license plates like Massachusetts, or maybe Kentucky, or perhaps Tennessee. And, of course, we'd walk past the truck on our way to school, and at the first time you wouldn't notice it. And then the next day you'd walk past, and there'd be the truck. And now you'd start hitting it, you know. When you go past, you start belting it. And a couple of days later, kids are sitting on the front seat, you know, going, rum, rah, 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 rah. Well, on the fourth day, it turns out that someone opens the back and finds two guys shot with machine gun slugs lying on the floor in a pool of blood. That was a hijacked truck. And the truck would then disappear. And a couple of months later, another one would appear. Once in a while, it was beautiful to see. Once in a while, a truck would appear in the neighborhood. And this was a very quiet little... immediately, you're thinking this is a tough neighborhood. No, this would be like if it was happening in, say, a Teaneck. Yeah, roughly that, because we were in between, you see. This wasn't a tough neighborhood. We were just there, near there, you know. It would be like if all the mobs on the Lower East Side were to start dumping all their bodies in River Edge, you know. Well, you know, it got to be pretty interesting. And once in a while, there would be a truck, and then there would be a lot of excitement because the neighborhood would all pour out. A truck would appear in the morning, and there on the side, you would see, just right across it, a long line of machine gun slugs. Just somebody stitched right across it to stop them. Well, the way they used to do this, they'd catch these guys coming up from Kentucky, and they would usually have a truck that would say on the side, Murphy Moving Company, we move pianos. Well, the word would get out among the mob that a big load of bourbon is coming up from Kentucky, and the truck marked the Murphy Moving Company van. And there were two guys, one named Greasy Thumb McMurdo and another guy named Lefty Lipschitz. Both of them are going to be operating this truck. Now, they're operating for the Capone mob. Now, at 2:30 a.m., they're going to make their pickup in Rabbit Hash, Kentucky. And at 2:45, they will be crossing the bridge at Covington. And then at 4:15 a.m., they will be at West Lafayette, Indiana. We get them between West Lafayette, you got it, and Crown Point. We'll dump the truck in Hammond. All right. All set, men? Well, they would wait, you see. They'd hide in the weeds by U.S. 41. And sure enough, about 4 o'clock in the morning, coming along the road would be a big truck, and on the side it would say, Murphy moving. And then immediately out of the bushes would come two big black Packards and a Chrysler 8. Well, they would move like shadows down the road with their lights out behind the Murphy truck. And then they slowly pull up, and suddenly old Greasy Thumb looks out, and oh, he sees what's happening. A black Packard. He sees the snub-nosed snout of a Thompson submachine gun poking out of the front window. He knows what to do. He stops that truck quick. Well, now, there's two things that happen. One or the other happens. Either Louie and Greasy Thumb are able to get into the bushes quick enough, or else Louie and Greasy Thumb wind up in the back of the truck next to the spare tire under the tool kit. Well, it's just that way, and that's the way it worked. And one night, poor old Mr. Mattingly is counting up his change next to the cash register, next to his big box, his big wooden box of credit books. The time is now 7:15, and he is quietly counting up his $38.47 that he has taken in from the roundhouse and from the open hearth on this day. It is a quiet day. There is a little nip in the air. It is pumpkin time. In fact, in just a few short weeks, it will be Thanksgiving. And Mr. Mattingly is counting his day's take. Mrs. Mattingly is in the back, battening down the hatches in the refrigerator. When suddenly there is a tapping at the door. And the shade has been drawn. Mr. Mattingly says, "We're closed!" The tapping continues. Mattingly opens the shade a little bit, and he finds he is looking right into the barrel of a .45 snub-nosed automatic. "Open up!" Mattingly opens up. In walks three thugs, and he can see through the doorway, parked outside on Kennedy Avenue, a long, black, spear-nosed Packard straight eight. The big four-door. He turns around, moves back towards the cash register, hits the nose sail, reaches in, picks up the $38.74, turns around and looks at the three men. Mrs. Mattingly, back in the refrigerator, is now coming out with some bacon in her hand for supper. She says, "What's the matter, John?" He says, "Get back in the refrigerator!" With that, she slams the door, and he makes a run for it, up the stairs to get up into the apartment where they lived. The man standing with the gun takes two shots. Pow! Pow! And Mattingly is now beyond reach. The three of them turn, and one of them, oddly enough, grabs a can of peanuts on the way out. Platters peanuts, tears out across the sidewalk and into the car. Mattingly now has the window on the second story open. He has his .22 target pistol. He also has his 12-gun, his 12-gauge rabbit gun and duck gun ready. And he sees this black mass moving. Boom! There goes one shot of the 12. It is a double gauge, a double barrel over and under. Boom! There goes the other one. Both shots point blank into the roof. He then takes up his .22, and as it moves on down across the street, going hell-bent for election, pow, 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 six shots. After the sixth shot, he collapses, hits his head up against the iron radiator, and lays still. Mrs. Mattingly comes up the stairs, and there is John lying in a pool of blood. he has been hit. She screams, turns around, clips on down the stairs, grabs the telephone, calls the cops, runs out on the street where about five mill workers have begun to gather already. They have come out of Flick's Tavern, opens the door, and just stands on the curb and screams, says nothing but screams. The mill workers come pouring in, and they see the blood. They follow the blood up, and they find Mr. Mattingly lying in his own gore next to the iron radiator. And they begin to work on him. Old Doc Slicker comes from above the drugstore, and he comes tearing in. It's the first gunshot he's seen outside, the first gun wound he's really seen outside an occasional hunter that's popped one or the other off. He kneels down and starts to work on Mattingly. Mattingly slowly comes to and looks around and says, did I get him? Well, that was the first time that anybody thought about getting him. With that, they say, get who? He says, I shot him. Well, everybody poured back out and left Mattingly lay on the street. They poured right back out and looked around to see what happened out there. And sure enough, there was blood all over the sidewalk. Apparently, Mattingly had really hit him. And by this time, four squad cars had arrived, and the entire neighborhood is pouring out, and the word has begun to circulate, Dillinger has struck Mattingly's. Dillinger did it again. Well, the next morning, they found the Packard next to a railroad siding about 2 miles away. The interior of the Packard was bloody from one end to the other. Nothing but gore. The three men had disappeared. And there were great banner headlines. Small town merchant wings Dillinger. Small town merchant fights back. Blasts way out of robbery. John Dillinger last night struck at Mattingly's grocery store on Kennedy Avenue. John Dillinger himself faced Mr. Mattingly, and twice received slugs in the back. And it was absolutely a fight to the finish. But good will out. Well, about 5 or 6 days after that, Mattingly had the biggest, most swinginest business in the neighborhood. He became famous all over entire Lake County. Until one day, a note appeared in the Hammond Times. It said, my name is Dillinger. I never held up a guy named Mattingly. I don't mess around with small-time guys. And unless he stops popping off, I'm going to start messing around. And that was the end of the story.